the July 2023 edition of Roundabout, the Dawlish and Tynmouth area talking newspaper's monthly magazine. I'm Camilla Taylor. While most of June seemed very warm, sunny and dry, July seems to have started off with slightly cooler weather and with rainfall, both of which are a welcome change, if not for most of us, then for the plants. Here is what we have in store for you for July. There is the Jennifer Meets interview with Valerie Forrester, followed by her choice of music. Babs Astley will be reading her poem entitled Hope. Stephen Taylor and Mary MacDonald will be discussing the book The Love Song of Miss Queenie Hennessy by Rachel Joyce. Aileen Clarkson will be sharing her letter from a dog walker. Fran Frank will be talking about picnic food. John Townsend will be sharing some anecdotes on the theme of embarrassment. This will be followed by a piece of music to conclude the programme. We start off with Jenny Jenkins and her guest, Valerie Forrester.
Hello, dear listener. Today we have another person behind the voice for you, our very own chairman, Valerie Forrester. So, Valerie, welcome to the other side of the microphone.
Thank you, Jenny.
Well, having a background of broadcasting, you have been in our ears since 2014, the very beginning of Here and Now and our special magazine, Roundabout. But first, let's start with your early life. When and where were you born and what did your parents do?
Well, I was born on the 18th of January 1938. Probably a mistake, as my brother was 17 years old at the time. My mother was trained as a milliner, but she never worked. And my dad did various jobs in the war and ended up managing butcher shops. I know he was in the First World War because he lied about his age, but I don't really know why he wasn't in the Second World War. Mm. I was born in Newport, Monmouthshire, which of course is in Wales. And there I started dancing at 4 years of age. I can't remember a lot about the war, which is what everybody asks when you're as old as I am, except that I used to spend a lot of time with my grandmother in Penarth. And to save us from any falling bombs, the pair of us used to sit under her cross-legged table with the big tablecloth on it. And she would wear a saucepan on her head, and I would wear a saucepan on my head, suitably sized in case any bombs dropped. That's all I really remember.
That's a lovely image you've painted there. Tell me your story then. How got into dancing, basically?
We moved to Penarth when I was nine because my grandmother had died. And my grandfather wanted his daughter, my mother, to look after him. I had a very good education in Newport up until that age. So when I went to Penarth and started at the primary school there, I found everything very easy, apart from Welsh, which I had never heard before. Oh. And I passed for Penarth County Grammar School when I was 10. But of course you couldn't leave school until you were 16, mm-hmm. which meant that I was in the class for taking my school certificate when I was 15. So I duly took the school certificate at 15. But all my friends left at 16, except me. I had to go on, and I spent 3 months in school, and I really loved it in the sixth form. But my father had other ideas, and as soon as I was 16 on the 18th of January, he told me I had to leave school because he'd booked me into a secretarial college. So we had a big fight because the last thing I wanted to do was be in an office sitting there, blah, blah, blah. But I thought about it and I thought, well, he's paying for this. And I just really enjoyed my school life, but I only wanted to dance. So I hadn't worked as hard as I should have done. So in that year at Secretarial College, I did work hard eventually and never regretted it.
But I think before that, you were mostly interested in your dancing
career. Yeah, I was.
Career.
Yes.
So if you could tell me a little bit more about your dancing talents and what that led to when you joined the Methodist Youth Club.
Well, I mean, I started dancing when I was four. Then when we moved to Penarth, my mother's great friend was a Madame Beaton. She had this troupe of girls who went into pantomime, and you were in the pantomime from the ages of 12, 13 and 14, from being the smallest, the middle one and the largest, or the tallest. And so I went in at 12. Of course, my schoolwork came second. I mean, we didn't leave the pantomime itself until 10 o'clock at night. So we were on the last bus home. And I remember standing in the school hall in the mornings, yawning my head off.
Oh dear.
And pantomimes there lasted for 3 months. You started
yeah,
rehearsals.
Before
Christmas. And then it went on till the end of March. But I loved all of that, yes. But that came first.
That came first, of course. Did you get any awards when you were doing your dancing?
Yes, I did go in for all the exams there were to go in for. So I got Royal Academy of Dance awards up until the fifth grade. And I also got the Royal Institute of Dance Teachers awards up to the fourth grade. I didn't do my teaching diploma, which I could have done, which I tended to regret later in my life. But yes, I went as far as I could with all the exams.
Brilliant. And what about the NYC?
Well, I was also a member of the Methodist Church, and our particular church in Penarth had a fantastic youth club. Once a year, the Methodist Association of Youth Clubs met in the Albert Hall in London and did a performance.
And all the
youth clubs all over the country arrived there, and some did comedy acts, some did singing, choirs. Mm. There were all sorts of things. But the two people in my church, John Gibbs, was a producer-director of our drama group, and his wife, Sheila Gibbs, used to write plays. And she wrote the last religious mime at the end of one of the rallies. And in that drama, I played the part of Mary Magdalene, mm-hmm. Which was very emotional, but which went mm-hmm. down very well. But one of the funniest things that happened there was underneath the Albert Hall are all the dressing rooms, which is like a rabbit warren. Mm-hmm. There are corridors going here, there and everywhere. And somehow all our youth club group had gone from the Albert Hall before my best friend Claire and I. So when we found ourselves outside the Albert Hall, we had no idea where our coach was to take us back to Penarth.
Goodness.
So as in one did in those days, we asked these two policemen who were sitting on their bicycles outside the building. So we went up and said, oh, we can't find our coach. What are we going to do? And they said, hop on. So Claire hopped on one crossbar and I hopped on the other. And they cycled round the Albert Hall until they found our coach.
Oh, what would your mother have said?
Yes, it was very good.
Well, I guess that we have to move on a little bit from there. I'm getting into your career now, and I think you told me you worked for the Law Society.
I did work for the Legal Aid Department of the Law Society when I first left college. But then I saw on the television that the production executive of TWW, which was Television Wales and the West at Poncana Studios in Cardiff, was looking for a secretary. So I applied and I got the job. So I went to work there and, oh, that was fantastic, you know. My father wasn't at all keen. You don't know what types you're going to meet there. You know, you might not be safe, all sorts of things like that.
Yeah.
And at 20 years of age, I completely ignored him and went, and it was fantastic.
Because you're working for TWW TV.
Yes, yes.
So now we can do a bit of name dropping. Come on.
Well, yes. I mean, Shirley Bassey came, I remember, when, of course, she was at the Well, she was roughly the same age as me. I can remember seeing her dress she was going to wear on television, which was all feathers, fantastic affair, but very, very heavily boned, so that she looked as if she was not what she was, really, because she was only a slip of a girl. Yes, and Johnny Dankwith and Cleo Lane had a couple of programmes there. Then when we got engaged to be married, my husband...
You'd met Dick by that time.
Yes.
He was working there, was he?
Well, before we actually became friends as such, we had a party at the studio. He asked me to dance, and I found out from dancing with him that he was a fantastic ballroom dancer. Mm. So of course we really clicked, and things carried on from there. But the funny thing was that because I was so busy dancing and doing drama and in the church and everything, we could never find an evening for him to take me out. So we used to have to go out in the lunch hours.
You were fitted in. I think I've got the name Spike Milligan now.
Oh, right.
Tell me what you did with him.
Well, when my husband went to open these Bristol television studios, I remained in Cardiff for about 3 months and worked in the newsroom, which was really interesting. Makeup department, again, which was interesting. But they then wanted to do this TV quiz show called Vice Versa with Spike Milligan. Well, Spike Milligan needed a stooge to run through his rehearsals, so I became his stooge. And I can remember lying on this hospital trolley while he raced round the studio floor with me nearly falling off it. And also, I had to find all the contestants for this quiz show, which I did, and had them all lined up, ready to go on, 6 to a programme with a commercial break. And the first half, he'd got through 5 of them. And I thought, what am I going to do the second half? I've just got one pair of contestants left, and, you know, I'm going to have to go on myself or find somebody else in the audience. But, of course, he dragged out the last one, so it was all right, but my heart was in my mouth. Oh, so my that was good fun, yes.
Now I'm going to take a leap forward again, because you did get married, as you said, and then you moved and you had 2 sons. That's and right. You were living at a place called Farnborough.
That's right.
Near
it's
Bath.
A village between Bath and Wells, yes.
And then you said over the 12 years there you started, again, very active, a WI group, a drama group, and worked at play school. I did get this all right, I think. But then I've got here that, I don't understand, you bought a cottage at Shoreden and moved there.
Now,
did that come about?
Well, when we were in Farnborough, I mean, we had a village atmosphere there, which was great. And I suppose you could call me a starter-upper. My eldest son was about 3, 4, and he didn't have anyone to play with. So I started a play group, and my husband made all the equipment. A nurse colleague helped me because I wasn't qualified. And I used to go round in my very bouncy Morris Oxford and pick up children from all the outlying farms and districts like that.
I see.
They used to bounce around in my car and bring them to this play group. And also the WI I joined, and they didn't have a drama group, so I started a drama group there.
Wonderful.
It was still going when I left the village 12 years later, with men wanting to join as well. It was such fun.
Oh, well done.
Yes, yes. And of course, we had the inevitable barbecues in the back of our bungalow, where most of the village used to come to.
Sounds a riot.
And then the police, yes, would always knock on the door and say, we've had complaints. So we used to invite them in as well. But,
well done. What a good plan that
they
is.
They didn't, yes. So that was a very good time in my life. And then my husband decided to leave television. And
yes.
He'd always wanted to work in wood. And so we came down to Tynmouth. Well, we'd had a cottage in Shoreden for a little while, but we decided to come to Tynmouth. My youngest son, there was 9 years between them, so he was just 3 when we came. And my husband started making children's toys, garden furniture, all that sort of thing. And then I started working once my son started school.
Well,
I became medical secretary in Tynmouth.
Well, I've got the next heading, which I'd like you to enlarge upon. You became interested in the atmospheric railway at Dawlish.
Yes.
And what did that lead to?
Well, that was quite exciting when my husband said, come and look at this building with me. And we went in and it was knee deep in pigeon droppings, hardly any roof, etc. But he wanted to build an atmospheric railway like Brunel. And this was Brunel's pumping house in Starcross. So we decided to do that, and he built a flat, well, re-roofed it, he built a flat in the top of the building.
This is the big brick building, the stone building you can see when you drive through Dawlish, between the
Star Cross,
and the river.
That's right, yes, it's a huge old building.
Beautiful. How did you lived there in this flat at the top of this crumbling edifice?
He made everything that was in the building, that because no artifacts existed for the atmospheric railway, so he made replicas of them all in wood.
And opened it up as a museum,
yes,
I believe.
Yes, yes.
And you were living there, running the museum, working, had a
family. Yes, for 10 years.
Ten years.
Yes, met all sorts of people from all over the world.
And then, tragically, in December 1999...
Yes, well, my husband developed cancer and I retired from work at 60 and he was 10 years older than me, but he did live for a year and I looked after him then. And then they asked me to go back to work, which I did, so I retired twice because I retired again at 65. And really, as a way of getting over that, I joined everything. I joined the Ladies' Guild, I joined the Garden Society, went on walks, yes.
And then I think we're getting now to the present time and the start of the Here and Now Talking newspaper. Can you tell us how that began? I remember, because I was there.
Well, yes, it was just Clarissa Wilson and Sue Bertel, two friends of mine, were losing their sight. And they didn't know what was going on. And they just said to me, oh, it's so frustrating. We never know what's happening. We can't go to anything. So I went to Dawlish Town Council and I stood there and said, it would be a good idea, I think, if we started something for these visually impaired. And they gave me enough money to have leaflets printed and I had something put in the paper. And when I actually had a meeting, the number of volunteers turned up was 40, and I couldn't believe so many people were interested. Along the way, after I'd done all this and looked at all places to have a studio, Jonathan Webster came on the scene. That was an absolute lifesaver because he had been a radio presenter, and so he built the studio in Dawlish, which we have.
We have to add that he was the husband of our dog walker.
Dog walker, Aileen.
So you had the dynamic duo there.
Yes. So that was, you know, really made it. Yes. And we went forward from there.
And how did you actually get the studio in Dawlish for our use?
I had looked at other places already, and then I took Jonathan there and we went upstairs at the back of the Strand Church, and he chose the room. There were about three rooms empty, and he chose the smallest because he thought that would be most suitable for sound recording. And he put all the equipment in, as you know, and we record in there to this day.
So it ended up with several teams of people doing the weekly news reading. Can you explain how that works out?
Yes.
And then roundabout.
We had the 40 volunteers and we divided teams up, which really consisted of about five or six or seven people. And we had four teams, red, blue, yellow and green, and they came on different weeks, only once a month, of course, and they record the Dawlish Gazette and the Tynmouth Post. And then Jonathan found this brilliant group of people who could write their own stories, like yourself, and do interviews, music, poetry, and we call that Roundabout. And that's our monthly magazine, which goes out, which is something that everybody should be listening to.
Well, it's certainly been fun to be part of that. It really has, and kept us all on our toes. Coming towards that point, I would like to ask you if you could choose a piece of music to play us out and why you chose it.
Well, I've chosen this because my happiest times, well, one of my happiest times has been in pantomime. And this reminds me of the principal boy walking on stage in her tricorn hat and her lovely satin suit and her fishnet tights. This is what she was singing. And I think this will be a man singing it because Gordon McRae sang it in Oklahoma. And I'm sure you'll all join in with it.
What is
it? Oh, what a beautiful morning.
Oh, marvellous. Well, thank you, Valerie, very much for coming and sparing your time to tell us about little bits of your very interesting life and how you actually came to be part of Tynmouth and Dawlish.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we have to say a fond farewell to our listener. So, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And thank you very much.
There's a bright golden haze on the meadow. There's a bright golden haze on the meadow. The corn is as high as an elephant's eye, and it looks like it's climbing clear up to the sky. Oh, what a beautiful morning. Oh, what a beautiful day. I got a beautiful feeling, everything's going my way. All the cattle are standing like statues, all the cattle are standing like statues. They don't turn their heads as they see me ride by, but a little brown maverick is winking her eye. Oh, what a beautiful morning. Oh, what a beautiful day. I got a beautiful feeling, everything's going my way. All the sounds of the earth are like music. All the sounds of the earth are like music. The breeze is so busy, it don't miss a tree. And old weeping willow is laughing at me. Oh, what a beautiful morning. Oh, what a beautiful day. I got a beautiful feeling, everything's going my way. Oh, what a beautiful day.
That song was Oh, What a Beautiful Morning, from the musical Oklahoma, sung by Gordon McRae. If you think you have heard this song in Roundabout before, then you are not mistaken. May 2022 marked the 75th anniversary of the West End production of this musical, and so we featured this song in the May 2022 programme. We now have Babs Astley with her very own poem entitled Hope.
Hope. There's a light at the end of the tunnel, is often what people say. But sometimes that light seems very dim and a very long, long way away. That's when you know who your friends are, for they help you to see that dim glow. And they never let you feel lonely or unloved when you feel really low. Family too are such a dear treasure, as their support and love never wanes. They are there to comfort when needed and help to mask any pains. There is beautiful nature around us, on the land, in the sky and at sea. The creatures that are close and distant give happiness and peace to me. So there is a light at the end of the tunnel, and it gets closer and closer each day, until at last it will be much less distant, and hopefully it'll be here to stay.
That was a very sweet, inspiring poem, wasn't it? Babs writes poems and stories on all manner of subjects. If you have a request for a poem or story from Babs on a subject of your choice, then please get in touch with your request.
Hello, listener. This month, Stephen and I have been looking at Rachel Joyce's The Love Song of Miss Queenie Hennessy, which is a parallel book to, I can't remember.
The Pilgrimage of Harold Fry.
Pilgrimage of Harold Fry. It runs parallel, triggered for me by the fact that I read the Harold Fry book some years ago, and there's recently been a film, which I went to see. I can't deny it. And it made me want to read this book. So I hope you enjoy listening to it as well, because it's just marvellous. So touching, so moving. And I won't say the end.
Well, yes, this book is it's not really a sequel, is it?
It's
the second
of
a trilogy,
really.
And it runs in parallel. Yeah. So you need to know a little bit about The Pilgrimage of Harold Fry. So you may well be familiar with this book. It's quite well known. It was a huge bestseller 10 years ago. But it's all about a man who lives near here in Kingsbridge, who walks the entire length of England right up to the Scottish border to Berwick-on-Tweed to visit a former work colleague of his who's called Queenie Hennessy, who is dying and in a hospice. She has cancer, and he's sending her postcards on the walk and so on. And this book tells exactly the same story, but from her perspective. So she is the central character, and Harold Fry doing the walk is sort of off. He does arrive at the end, but he's secondary. She's writing a letter, or composing a letter to him, with the help of a nun who's working in the hospice with her. And this is really a confessional letter talking about her love for him. She had a serious, unrequited affair with him. She adored him when she was working with him. And it's all about her feelings towards him and his family, particularly his son, who she also became friendly with and who had a very tragic life. And it's also about the other people who live in the hospice and who are there with her and their relationships, as well as the staff in the hospice. And it is very, very sad.
It is sad.
This is not a book to read if you're looking for uplifting, cheerful stuff.
But it is, in a way. It's uplifting in a way, because Harold set off on this journey in his flip-flops, practically, just to post a letter or something simple. And he'd had this letter about Queenie, and he just decided to go and see her. And off he set across Devon and Somerset. But he kept sending her, eventually, postcards, which acquired fame. He acquired fame. And neither of them knew this. But the hospice picked up on it because they had visitors and they had press. Can't beat press. And that's what links the two stories together, really, is the relationship between them, yes, in the past, and her love for him, and of course her love for the boy, her son, who she sees so much of Harold in. But it's lovely from that side. I found a lot of the comments and the insights in the hospice absolutely fascinating, because lots of us are like that or become like that, and privacy is lost. They try to keep it, but this overshadows all that. Privacy is gone because Queenie's life is revealed. Every postcard that comes, everybody assumes that there was a great passion in the past. But there was, but it was unrequited.
That's right. There are some amusing characters. Some of the people she's in the hospice with are very, very funny,
yes.
the remarks they make. But the trouble is they all die. I mean, it's obvious, you know, but basically she's created this book where she creates lovely characters and then she kills them all off, one after another after another.
But they do it so beautifully. It's seriously operatic.
She says she has
this lovely experience. They had this wonderful conversation the next morning. The undertaker came. And it's like that all the time. And it does make you laugh at times.
But there's a sort of life-affirming aspect to it. And it's the story of her life, which, although it has a great sadness, she's also very optimistic and bouncy and fun in the way she tells the story.
And she's done a lot of good things and fun things in that life, in the 20-odd years or whatever. She's had a great life elsewhere, and she's met lots of charming people. She's enjoyed social relationships with lots of people that she's met. And in a way, Queenie's coming to her own in that later life, partly because of her experience of her relationship or non-relationship with Harold. So, yes, it's...
Well, he's the key figure in her life, yes. And it's that revelation, really, that's so interesting. And it is beautifully written. I mean, this is a very, very well-crafted, superbly written book. It draws you in. I listen to the audio, which is read by the actress Celia Imrie.
Oh,
just
yes.
Wonderful. Yes. So, so beautifully done. And the end, there's a little twist at the end.
Wonderful twist at the end.
Which you don't see coming and which makes it very satisfying.
But it is still visual. Harold's journey is all visual. You could see in your mind's eye everywhere. I thought this wouldn't be, but it is. It's just as visually drawing. Mentally, you can picture everything she talks about and all the ways that come along.
And there's a third one. There is another book.
Oh, you've got me there.
Which I'm going to have to read now.
Absolutely.
The title of the book that Mary MacDonald and Stephen Taylor have just reviewed is The Love Song of Miss Queenie Hennessy by Rachel Joyce. This book is available in hardcover, paperback, and as a downloadable audiobook. We now have Aileen Clarkson with her letter from a dog walker.
Dear listener, for almost all of June, both inside and outside of the house, we have been experiencing very high daytime temperatures. However, life on the inside has been made bearable by the through draft from an open garden door on the ground floor and an open balcony door on the middle floor. Honey flops from one cool spot to another, and we both drink plenty of water throughout the day. Our long walk has, if at all possible, been rescheduled to after we have had our evening meal. Yesterday, at around 7:30, during our walk through the dappled coolness within Oakland's woods, we met, coming towards us, a young man carefully carrying a child in his arms. The child's arms and legs dangled limply, and the man put a finger to his lips. He whispered that his son had found it impossible to go to sleep in the heat of his room, so instead of putting him in his pushchair or going out in the car, he'd come to the woods for the gentle sound of the birds and the cool surroundings. This had done the trick, and they were returning to their nearby home. Honey and I continued on to the fields at the back of the woods. We have been collecting the odd wild flower and their decorative seed pods to help with my arrangement for the flower festival in St. Michael's Church, Tynmouth, in the last week of June. The theme is creation, oh, our world, and my volcano base stands at the end of the table where I am sitting writing to you, waiting to be topped up with flowers. What they will be will depend on what is available in the shops locally, but they must be the colour of a volcano. The base foliage will come from my garden. I have a maroon-coloured smoke bush, bright yellow peris, variegated laurel, a bundle of dry palm fronds bleached yellow by the sun, and anything I find attractive when I go out with my secateurs in the morning of the set-up day. Last Saturday, although it was another very hot day, Honey and I had a slow walk in Mules Park in the middle of the day, because we were both going to visit some friends in Shoreden for the afternoon. To protect my head from the sun, I wore my garden hat, which is a faded purple, and its brim is encircled with many different false flowers. It has evolved to its present existence over many years. When first purchased over 20 years ago, it was a violet colour and an exact match to my outfit for a trip to Ladies' Day at Ascot Races. It was beautiful and expensive. Over the years it has been adapted for fancy dress and worn by various members of my family. Finally, it became my very comfortable and colourful gardening hat. It has definitely earned every penny of its purchase price. Honey did not have a hat on Saturday, so we kept to a shaded area as much as possible, and she was offered water at regular intervals. We arrived in Shoreden just before 2 o'clock, and Honey was off like a bullet out of a gun, without a backward glance, to explore the truly lovely large garden with Spaniel Pip, the resident dog. From their first meeting, the two have been great friends, and Pip unselfishly shares all his toys with her. Her walk before we arrived ensured that it was not long before she was fast asleep in a cool corner. Our walks in the evening have included visits to Tynmouth Promenade and the Den, where various events have been taking place inside a large marquee bar. The most recent was a folk festival, and there are regular events to follow. On the 1st of July, the Tynmouth Air Show will start with the Red Arrows. Honey does not like the noise, so we'll stay at home and watch from there. It is time for bed. Honey has paid her last visit to the garden, and after making sure all doors are locked and all lights are switched off, we head upstairs to our beds. Without fail, Honey will carry a ball to her bed in the vain hope that I might like to play before going to sleep. If I have missed the evening news, I will watch the 10 o'clock news while I get ready for bed. After the weather forecast for the next day, I switch off, and often I will read a little before putting the light off. I don't draw the curtains, because there is nothing outside except the open expanse of Lime Bay, which stands ready to reflect the breathtaking light of the next full moon. Kindest regards, the dog walker.
Here is Fran Frank to talk about a range of delectable and mouth-watering picnic food.
Hello again. Now that summer is here, the idea of eating outdoors, whether it be on the patio at home, at an outdoor event in the countryside, or maybe on the local beach, becomes more appealing as long as the local insects behave themselves. Making sure the venue is comfortable is important, but the choice of food and drink is essential. In a recent magazine article, I noticed that some restaurants and cafes are now offering ready-packed picnic hampers, at a price, I might add. Their suggestions for an interesting summer picnic include smoked salmon, caviar, and prawns, together with various sliced meats such as salami and chorizo. Add some specialist breads and baguettes to the hamper for use as sandwiches or just to rip and share, plus a few salad items with dressings to give them flavour. Finish this off with a bottle of champagne or other type of fizz, and then take out a small mortgage to pay for it. A little too contrived for me, but I'm sure that some people appreciate the convenience, especially if it is for a very special event. As far as I can remember, when I was growing up during the 50s, my parents would regularly take me and my brother out for the day, either to Dartmoor or onto one of the local beaches. My mum, who didn't have a lot of money to spare, would take a loaf or some crusty bread rolls, a block of cheddar cheese, a couple of tomatoes, and whatever fruit was in the larder. All of these things went into the picnic tin. You know, the one that came with the biscuit variety at Christmas. She'd also put in some butter and maybe a small jar of chutney if Dad wanted that on his cheese rather than a tomato slice. Of course, she also had to remember a couple of knives, one for spreading the butter and one for slicing. Otherwise, none of us would have got any food. Drinks were very simple. It was tea or water. Like all dads in the 50s, mine had a Primus stove in the back of the car, which would be produced as soon as we found our chosen picnic spot, and the kettle would soon be boiling. In fact, I can also remember when, on certain days, a couple of slices of bacon were produced and put into a small frying pan where it started sizzling away until the smells and flavours were fantastic. Nowadays, if I consider a picnic, I usually go for the traditional food choices, but with an extra twist. I start with a couple of crusty rolls filled with good quality cheese or ham off the bone. Fill a separate container with some plum tomatoes and cucumber chunks that can be eaten easily with fingers, and add some grapes and possibly a banana as a dessert. As far as drinks, I have to admit that a cool glass of wine, or Devon cider, goes down very well on a warm sunny day. But if the temperatures are a little cooler, then a hot cup of coffee or tea is much appreciated. As far as the twist is concerned, I am partial to a helping of freshly cooked chips with vinegar, if they're available. Or dare I mention it, a portion of spicy noodles. Well, now I've made my stomach rumble, I think I'd better finish this recording and go check the fridge to see if I've got anything to make up a picnic for the garden. Enjoy the rest of the summer.
We now have John Townsend to blush and tell some anecdotes from his past.
I hope to spare your blushes, but here's a question for you. What is the name for a group of giant pandas? Yeah, I know it's a bit of a random question, seeing as we don't even have one in Devon, let alone a group. But just like other strange collective nouns, such as a parliament of owls and a murder of crows, pandas have their own unusual term. So what, you may well ask? Seeing as pandas are solitary animals, does it matter anyway? But bear with me. Yes, they are officially bears, actually. But as you never know when the next pub quiz is coming your way, you may just thank me for reminding you of the term for a panda party, even though you may blush at the answer. So here's a clue. Let me tell you of a few true incidents from my youth, all designed to steer you towards that word for pandas, should you ever wish to know. If not, just sit back and squirm as I recall my shameful past. I was once on the lookout for a pair of new trousers, smart ones, and found myself in Guildford, Surrey, where I happened upon a somewhat old-fashioned gentleman's outfitters, the sort that no longer exist, and I was surprised they did then. It was an old rickety building full of small rooms at different levels, up and down stairs, and all smelling of the paraffin heaters wafting their fumes throughout. Each room was lined with antique drawers and shelves, packed to the rafters with shirts, garters, cummerbunds of every description and for every occasion. I found the trouser room tucked away at the back behind an impressive display of undergarments for the senior gentleman of larger proportions. I was the only person in the room as I scoured the trouser racks and eventually found a black pair in my size that might be worth a try. I took them to an assistant in another room and asked if I could try them on in the changing room.
"Sorry, there isn't one," was the reply. "It's out of action due to an electrical fault. You're welcome to try them on over there behind the counter. There's a mirror in the corner. I can stand at the door to keep guard."
So behind the counter I went, put the trousers by the till as I removed my jeans. Before I had chance to reach for the trousers, a woman came out of nowhere, clutching a pair of socks.
"Oh, can you tell me how much these are, please? There's no ticket."
I raised a finger to point to the assistant at the door, who was nowhere to be seen. Somewhat sheepishly, I stuttered, I'm not sure. Having worked in a shoe shop, I felt I could bluff my way in the world of retail, and even considered pretending I was a member of staff, in the hope the woman would go on her way and not notice my state of undress. But, inevitably, she stepped forward to look at more socks on the counter, and her eyes lowered, while her eyebrows rose with alarm. Her stare seemed to last a lifetime, made worse by an icy silence and an expression I've never known before or since. Attempting to carry on nonchalantly by rearranging coat hangers, I knocked the trousers off the counter, and I heard myself say, I don't work here, actually, and I've just dropped my trousers." Her mouth opened, but no words came. She hurriedly put down the socks, backed away, and was gone. I anticipated some kind of shrieking complaint from the next room, or at least the arrival of the manager demanding an explanation. Instead, the assistant returned after I was once again dressed, never having tried on the trousers at all.
"Any good, sir?"
"No, not quite. Not really my style. Never mind." I scuttled off before the police could arrive to analyse CCTV footage and arrest me for indecency in a public place. It's probably not even a crime to drop one's trousers in Devon, but, well, this was Surrey after all. My next cringing experience was in a cinema, one I'd never been in before, and once again one of the old variety, just one auditorium and somewhat run down. It was a last-minute decision to see a film, so I went alone, arriving just after the trailer started. At the ticket office, they told me to go straight in, down the corridor, and it was very quiet as I approached the double doors and entered into the darkness beyond. The door closed behind me, and all was pitch black as I fumbled my way to find a seat in this mysterious world of magical darkness. As I squinted to see the screen, I stumbled over what seemed to be a mop and crashed into a bucket. It was then the door behind me opened, and an usherette shone a torch into my face. "Oh, not in here, love. This is the broom cupboard." I emerged, red-faced, to the stifled giggles of staff as I was led in shame to my seat. Yes, that really did happen. A few years later, I joined a drama group at the village hall a few miles from home, where I was in the cast of the pantomime, playing a dame. I decided to drive to the dress rehearsal with makeup already on to save time. Wigs and frilly bloomers were strewn on the passenger seat, along with the music for my songs. As I drove in the darkness, I was singing heartily to practice when I was aware of a flashing blue light. The police car overtook and pulled me into the roadside. I could only sit and wait as two policemen got out and approached as I nervously wound down my window. They were in no hurry and seemed to relish my awkwardness. "Do you always sing when you're driving, sir?" Well, no, not really, officer. I'm in a pantomime, you see, and I was just..." "So, would that account for the lipstick, eyeshadow and unusual underwear on the front seat?" He shone his torch around the car while his colleague was obviously doing a DVLA check. "Name and address, sir?" When I typically told him, he smiled. "Well, that's nice and close, isn't it? Perhaps we should accompany you home, sir." "Well, yeah, but I'm going to the pantomime." "To make sure you're who you say you are. I take it you have a key to that address and can easily gain access without laddering your stockings." My drive home in humiliation was carefully observed and doubtless laughed at as I finally breathed a sigh of relief when they delivered me and drove off to catch the next unsuspecting singing cross-dresser. The next play I was in, I was a young man about town, seduced by the postmistress, well, at least her character, who she played with a flirty vulgarity that the part demanded. At a rehearsal, I was delighted to see she arrived in a suitably mutton-as-lamb costume, perfect for the part. "Oh, I love the gross outfit. Ideal tacky dress for your tasteless character. You look as common as..." The room fell silent. The cast froze. "Whatever do you mean? Dress rehearsals next week. These are my own clothes. I've been wearing them all day." Oops, how embarrassing. I was lucky not to end up with a couple of black eyes, a bit like a panda. Which brings me back to my original question. In case you hadn't guessed, a group of pandas is known as an embarrassment. I guess that might be because, like me, they tend to be somewhat shy, socially awkward, and forever putting their foot in it. Maybe I was a panda in a previous life. Incidentally, I dare to suggest an alternative collective noun for sick pandas. How about a pandemic? Or, for a mob of unruly pandas, a pandemonium. Yeah, well, I think I'd better leave it there, in the hope of avoiding any further excruciating embarrassment.
If you have Alexa at home and know how to use it, you will be pleased to know that you can now access our talking newspaper through it. Here are the instructions for it. Firstly, say, "Alexa, enable talking newspapers," and then follow the prompts. Then listen by saying, "Alexa, ask talking newspaper for Here and Now," or "Alexa, ask talking newspaper for Roundabout." We hope you find these instructions helpful and do let us know how you get on with using Alexa to listen to our programmes. Our final piece of music is the song Live and Let Die, written and sung by Paul McCartney. It is 50 years since the release of the Bond movie Live and Let Die, and the first to star Roger Moore as James Bond.
When you were young and your heart was an open book, you used to say, live and let live.
You know you did, you know you did, you know you did.
But if this ever-changing world in which we live in makes you give in and cry, say live and let die.
Live and let die.
Live and let die.
Our thanks go to Jenny Jenkins, Valerie Forrester, Babs Astley, Stephen Taylor, Mary MacDonald, Aileen Clarkson, Fran Frank, and John Townsend. Thanks also to Diana Coulson and Margaret Reynolds for copying and dispatching the USB sticks, and to Sarah Williams for uploading the programme to our website. The programme was compiled and produced by Camilla Taylor, and edited by Stephen Taylor and Mike Smith.